Good morning. My name is Nancy Horowitz, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the last program of this year's Monadnock Summer Lyceum season. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today we have two very special guests and a truly extraordinary program. David Haidu is our speaker, and he will be joined by Jill Sobule, who will be aiding in his presentation. Jill will then present a short concert after the Lyceum program is over. After the spoken presentation, the speaker will answer questions from the audience. David Haidu is an enormously talented individual that it's my pleasure to introduce. He's a professor of journalism at Columbia University, where he teaches arts journalism, including a segment on teaching his students to make art before they learn to critique it. He is the author of 5 award-winning books on topics ranging from the role of comic books in American culture to biographies of some of the 20th century's most influential musicians. One of the most respected arts critics in America, he is the staff music critic for The Nation, and he served as music critic for The New Republic for 12 years. In a career spanning more than 30 years, he has written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, The New York Review of Books, Harper's, among other publications. He's also a highly regarded songwriter, with songs on 5 albums released in recent years, including Waiting for the Angel, Songs with Words. I also want to say a few words about his musical collaborator, Jill Sobule. She's an acclaimed singer-songwriter in a smart and witty tradition. In more than 2 decades of recording and performing, Jill has mused on a wide range of fundamental subjects, including the death penalty, depression, anorexia, Alzheimer's disease, coming of age, and intolerance. She is continuing that legacy of social engagement with her important new collaborative project, My Song is My Weapon, which she describes as an online town square where people can gather to create, collaborate, and express their stories and concerns. She has recorded on over 11 albums to date, has performed in off-Broadway musicals, and made television appearances. Please join me in welcoming David Haidu.
Thank you, Nancy. Thanks to the organization for having me. It's a genuine thrill to be the first, I understand I'm the first person to speak publicly in Peterborough who's not running for president. Not yet. But there's something in the air here that's giving me the idea. Maybe I'll run. I'm here to talk today, as you know, on the subject of protest music. I have a conception of protest music and music of dissent, and music of social and political dissent that defies some of the conventions, as you'll see as we go along. I'm talking about the relationship between art and politics and society, specifically the art of music as an instrument of social and political dissent. Now, this is certainly, as we all know, a topical subject. I could barely get through an hour of the day today without thinking of the social and political upheaval that we're all in the midst of. My teenage son, who's 14, is here up there. That's Nate. He's 14. He's about to start high school next month. And we experienced together, along with his mom, my wife, a signal moment in the current upheaval in this country in January when we all marched together in the Women's March on Washington, which of course followed the inauguration of the current president. There that day, Nate got to experience the power of free speech in action in a democracy. He saw hundreds of thousands of people had come together from all around the country, united in the purpose of protesting the ideology and the character of the newly elected leader of their country. And he saw how music can serve as a mechanism to give assembled masses a common voice, to express passion and discontent, to stir people emotionally and intellectually, and to unite people, connecting them to the ideas and the lyrics of the music, the feelings in the music, and also to connect them to the larger history and tradition of unified dissent through songs that have been sung out in protest in this country for generations. The 2 songs that we heard repeatedly that day and the prior to the inauguration and various events were well known to everyone. That's why they were performed. Everybody knew them. They were, "We shall overcome, and this land is your land." You heard a version of it a little earlier. We're going to come back to it in a few minutes. Both of these songs significantly began their lives as spirituals. It's sort of fitting that we're in a house of worship to be talking about this because of the deep connection between spiritual life, social life, and political life, and the way that music functions communally and socially in both of those spheres, in the sphere of the church and the sphere of society and politics. I guess that's three spheres, isn't it? Now, both of these songs began as spirituals because sacred music, including music of the Black Church, but not exclusively the Black Church, is meant specifically to serve as a rallying cry, to instill hope and inspiration, and to work communally and socially. There's a scholar of religion, there's a colleague of mine at Columbia where I teach named Yosef Soret, and he's written extensively about the role of music in the Black Church. And as he pointed out in one of his writings, quote, "Religion is widely mistaken to be about belief. But faith is not so simple as something you believe. It's something you do. Music ties religious communities together. It unites people as they sing in unity." That's the end of the quote. At the same time, singing crystallizes and codifies beliefs through the very act of communal expression of the music's content. That's true of not only sacred music, but also true of protest music. When gospel songs are adapted to secular purpose, as both "We Shall Overcome" and "This Land Is Your Land" were, the same process applies. Singing a song, using your lungs and your throat and your mouth and your tongue to make the words and your feet to tap the time, maybe your hand to clap along or your whole body to sway to the beat, all this puts the content and the feeling of the songs in you in a visceral and in a literal way. Now, singing in unison goes even further as reverberations from the chorus of singers around you singing together rings through you. It has a palpable physical effect. "We Shall Overcome" began life as a gospel song with words and music by a person named the Reverend Charles Albert Tindley. He was a Methodist pastor in Philadelphia. It was published as "I'll Overcome Someday." Some of you may know it in that form. Published in 1900. Well, that means that the copyright's still intact. So Tindley's heirs own the copyright to that song, which is the basis of "We Shall Overcome." I don't think there are any lawsuits pending over this. But Disney hasn't gotten its hands on it yet. The text is derived from a passage of biblical text, and as adapted by Tindley, the original song begins like this. "The world is one great battlefield with forces all arrayed. If in my heart I do not yield, I'll overcome someday." As early as 1909, the song had been taken outside the church, sung at meetings of the United Mine Workers. Over time, "I'll Overcome Someday" evolved into "We Shall Overcome," drawing in part on an anti-slavery song called "No More Auction Block," which coincidentally is also the inspiration for "Blown in the Wind." And Dylan has admitted that he drew the melody for "Blown in the Wind" and the cadences of "Blown in the Wind" from "No More Auction Block," which figures into "We Shall Overcome." So "We Shall Overcome" is sort of a combination of "I'll Overcome Someday" and "No More Auction Block." That's how the folk process works. Songs develop over time. They take form through the accretion of contributions by multiple people. Various people making adjustments to the words in the music, cutting phrases, making elisions, adding phrases, adding words, adding new ideas, and adding notes. It's sometimes called the folk process, sometimes called the blues process, sometimes called appropriation, sometimes called copyright theft. It was Pete Seeger who made the pivotal change in the lyric, replacing "will" with "shall," mainly because he recognized "shall" as a more singable word. Pete said, "I changed the lyric," this is a quote from Pete, "I changed it to 'we shall' because I like a more open sound when I'm singing. We will has alliteration to it, but we shall opens the mouth wider. The I in will is not an easy vowel to sing well. Shall is more singable. That's the end of the quote. By the 1960s, We Shall Overcome became the anthem of the civil rights movement, largely through its use by Seeger, Joan Baez, and others in the folk movement of the time. Baez led the assembled crowd of 300,000 in singing the song at the Lincoln Memorial during the March on Washington. And Martin Luther King Jr. incorporated it in the words of the last speech he gave shortly before his assassination in March 1968. It was sung at Dr. King's funeral. It was sung by Barack Obama. It was sung by Barack Obama. We probably all saw that televised, and he started to tear up as he was singing it. Do you remember that? It was sung for Barack Obama by Pete Seeger and Bruce Springsteen. And as I've said, it was sung repeatedly at the Women's March in this country. At one point, adapted into the colorful We Shall Overcome. This... That's a good one, right? I'll ask Jill to sing a few verses from... No, I won't. She could, though. She could. Now, this land is your land had a similar provenance. It began as a spiritual, in this case, as a Baptist gospel song called Oh, My Loving Brother, which was adapted into a secular song with spiritual overtones called When the World's on Fire. Now, When the World's on Fire was recorded for commercial release on the Paramount record label by the Carter family, which was produced the urtext of American country music. Two sisters-in-law, Sarah and Maybell Carter, and the husband of Sarah, who had a trio. The two sisters-in-law were the heart of the group. They played the instruments, all the harp and guitar, and sang, and A.P. Carter sang harmony, played no instruments, and collected the songs that became the repertoire for the song, and also copyrighted them in his name without much concern for the true nature of their authorship. To continue on the thread of appropriation. I'm going to ask Jill to play, could you do a little bit of When the World's on Fire?
Sure, it sounds familiar. Oh, my loving mother, when the world's on fire, don't you want God's bosom to be your pillow? Tide me over in the rock of ages, rock of ages, cleft for me. Familiar.
You recognize the tune? Woody Guthrie said on the record that he never wrote a melody. That's not what he did. He adapted existing melodies to his purpose and set them to new lyrics. That's what he did, and he admitted that. In this case, he employed the melody of When the World's on Fire and set it to new lyrics. So the inspiration for his lyrics were his discontent with the phenomenon of the success of God Bless America at the time. Now, he had heard Kate Smith performing God Bless America, and he watched as God Bless America was taken up as an unofficial American anthem, and this riled him. And he wrote This Land Is Your Land in protest to that phenomenon. Now, he objected to God Bless America on two counts. One is that he considered it trite and jingoistic. And two, and this was his stronger objection to God Bless America, was the fact that it was created by a commercial songwriter from Tin Pan Alley. It riled him to see a piece of work by a commercial songwriter, by a Tin Pan Alley tunesmith, taken up as a song to represent the country. Guthrie loathed Tin Pan Alley and commerce in its most oppressive forms, and he considered the forces of the commercial music industry to be oppressive to artists and also to their audience. He saw a kind of hegemony in the dominance of the musical sphere by commercial American popular music. So he set out to write an answer song to God Bless America and composed what he originally called God Bless America for Me, to the tune of When the World's on Fire. Written in 1940, the original composition had two verses that did not appear in most of the subsequent performances of the song, which we're going to hear in a few minutes. Jill will sing the song with the two verses that were not performed for decades. Guthrie articulated his view of songs as a mechanism for social change in a letter that he wrote to the folklorist Alan Lomax. You know who Alan Lomax is? Key figure in the folk boom in the 1960s, a folklorist and the son of John Lomax, a Harvard academic who collected, was an early collector of American folk songs and American cowboy songs. In a letter to Lomax, Guthrie said, quote, "A folk song is what's wrong and how to fix it. Or it could be who's hungry and where their mouth is, or who's out of work and where the job is, or who's broke and where the money is, or who's carrying a gun and where the peace is. That's folklore. And folks made it up because they seen, he affected a kind of a down-home, cowpoke kind of patois. Even wrote a column for the Daily Worker called Woody Says, spelled S-E-Z, and had a radio program out of L.A. that where he spoke in this kind of like homespun vernacular because they seen that politicians couldn't find nothing to fix or nobody to feed or give a job of work to. So let's hear what he composed, tapping that frustration and that discontent and that passion and drawing from the whole history of American discontent in This Land Is Your Land.
Thank you. And I'm going to add the two ones that I didn't learn in grade school. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. As I went walking, I saw a sign there. And on that sign said, no trespassing. But on the other side, it didn't say nothing. This side was made for you and me. In the shadow of the steeple, I saw my people. By the relief office, I saw my people. As they stood there hungry, I stood there asking, is this land made for you and me?
Wow, wonderful. Can we applaud? Wow. 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 Guthrie reinforced his conviction in the power of protest through music by pasting a sign on his guitar that read, "This machine kills fascists." You've probably seen that in photographs of Guthrie. In the March on Washington, we saw folks carrying signs that said, "This machine kills fascists," with a drawing of female reproductive organs next to it. That was the machine. "This machine kills fascists." Among the chief targets of his songs were bankers, real estate moguls, Wall Street investors, and other big boys of commerce. At this point, I'm going to take a little turn in this presentation because I think that most of what I've said so far, you may have known or may have expected to hear. I'm going to take a turn and talk about some things you may not know or might not expect to hear in a discussion of protest music or music of dissent. Now, Guthrie had a point when he criticized Tin Pan Alley for its domination of popular music in the early 20th century. At the same time, however, he failed to see that commercial music gave voice to a fairly wide range of points of view. In fact, if you look at it closely, you'd see that popular music already had, at that point, a proven capacity to stir social change. This was a capacity that was widely unrecognized in Guthrie's circle and remains underrecognized today. There have, in fact, been strains of social and political dissent in popular songs since the beginning of American popular music in the late 19th century, and they've had a profound influence on generations of American. In a very real sense, the secret history of American dissent has been hidden in plain sight in our popular music. Case in point, let's consider the performing artist who was the most popular singer on the stages of vaudeville more than 100 years ago. Vaudeville being the place where American popular culture first took form. The biggest star in vaudeville was not George Burns or Bob Hope. The biggest star in vaudeville was Ava Tanguay, T-A-N-G-U-A-Y. Look her up, but you won't find videos and you won't find records, because Ava Tanguay and the other stars of vaudeville worked and thrived in a time before recording. The character of their work and the importance of their work is largely lost to history. She had a signature song. I wonder if anybody here knows what it is. Anybody know what Ava Tanguay's theme song was? She was called the I Don't Care Girl, because her signature song was a song called I Don't Care. Now, imagine that in the first decade of the 20th century. This is the Edwardian era, sort of the late Victorian era, and Ava Tanguay embodied a challenge to all the tropes of Victorian propriety, represented a radically daring, sexually assertive image of womanhood that made the so-called new woman, which is all the rage at the time in academic writing at the turn of the century, look old-fashioned already. She sang almost naked in a costume that seemed like nothing more than pennies pasted onto her skin. It was actually a bodysuit. She sang like a woman possessed in a way that defied all the norms of Victorian propriety. And she sang songs such as, "That's Why They Call Me Tabasco." And are you ready? "Go as far as you'd like with me." Her signature song was a distillation of the defiance that she exuded and popularized I Don't Care. The lyrics went like this: I don't care what they may think of me. I'm happy-go-lucky. Men say I'm plucky. So jolly and carefree. Jolly and carefree. I don't care. I don't care. Now, I'm not talking about a fringe figure in vaudeville. I'm talking about the most popular act of the era, the person who was billed as, quote, the star that made vaudeville famous. She challenged a generation of women and men to confront a revolutionary new set of values. She was a feminist before the phenomenon had a name, and she was a pop star before that term was popular. And she enacted the revolution that she enacted in music that was a form of social protest. Now, why music? Keep in mind that popular music is now and always was a social music. Its primary function is to bring young people together so that they can connect emotionally, communally, and physically. As such, it needs to speak directly to young people's concerns. Popular music is the medium of exchange in the social economy of youth. Young people engaged in the construction of their own generational identity, inevitably, by necessity, seek out modes of dressing, behaving, thinking, and acting that not merely differ from the modes of their parents' generation, but stand in defiance of them, as a critique of them. As a result, every generation is drawn to cultural products and ideas that challenge the standards and values of their parents. They're drawn to music that represents a protest to the norms of the day. Not long after Tanguay, just a few years after Tanguay, in the 1920s, country and Western music emerged in this country. I mentioned the Carter family. These were artists whose music is described by music historians as, quote, the big bang of country music. The music that the Carter family made is called the big bang of country music. As I said, it's a trio of two sisters-in-laws and a brother. The Carter family recorded for Paramount. They also recorded for Victor Records, which is the biggest record company in the country. And they had their first hit, the song that brought them the first taste of wealth with a song called Single Girl, Married Girl. I'm talking about a pop hit recorded by Victor Records, distributed everywhere, available by mail order by Montgomery Wards to people who are not close to stores. And here's how the lyrics went. Remember, this is the 1920s. Single girl, single girl. She goes to the store and buys. Oh, she goes to the store and buys. Married girl, she rocks the cradle and cries. Oh, she rocks the cradle and cries. Single girl, she's going where she please. Oh, she's going where she please. Married girl, baby on her knees. Baby on her knees. If that's not a protest song, I don't know what is. Now, the canon of American country music is rich with companionable expressions of female discontent, critiques of the social system that repressed women or saw them as no more than the willing prey of predatory males. The same milieu produced Stand By Your Man. Yes, it produced Stand By Your Man. Also gave us counterarguments, such as God Didn't Make Honky Tonk Angels, One's on the Way, and the song we're going to hear in two pages called The Pill by Loretta Lynn, which we'll come back to. Now, the case of God Didn't Make Honky Tonk Angels is a complicated and a challenging one, so I want to devote a couple of minutes of it to consider it, because it connects to all the ideas that I've laid out so far and also connects to the current political climate in a way that's discomforting. I warn you. In 1952, the number one hit on what was at the time called the Hillbilly chart, the term wasn't called the Country and Western chart. If you got Billboard magazine in 1952, you'd have to look up the Hillbilly chart. It was a song that was a blunt defense of male infidelity called The Wild Side of Life. Well, men can't help but be wild, and women are just there for the plucking. Co-credited to the early country songwriter William Warren and the record's producer, Hank Thompson, the song shifts the blame for all sorts of bad boy behavior to predatory temptresses. It was, here we are in the church, it was Genesis. Also set to the tune of another old Carter Family song called I'm Thinking Tonight of My Blue Eyes. At the urging of a producer for Decca Records, Kitty Wells, early country singer, recorded a response to the Thompson record. It was called, the kind of song still called an answer song, that stood up for the Honky Tonk Angels and reshifted the blame for their promiscuity to men, to Machiavellian men, to bar dogs, Machiavellian bar dogs. Both of the songs were sort of titillating and conventionally moralistic. They both made fairly conventional moral arguments. The big difference between the two of them was the gender that they accused of starting all the trouble. The Wells record made It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels. The Wells record that she made, God Didn't Make Honky Tonk Angels, was radical at the time for daring to defend scorned women, and it became the first number one hit by a female artist on the Billboard Country chart. It inspired countless female singers and songwriters to follow, including Patsy Cline, Loretta Lynn, Dolly Parton, and Jill Sobule. The lyrics say, "It's a shame that all the blame is on us women. It's not true that only you men feel the same. From the start, most every heart that's ever broken was because there was a man to blame." Now, my digression, the discomforting part of the digression is that even though that's a song that's properly recognized as an anthem of proto-feminism, it was written not by a woman, but by a man. It was written by J.D. Miller. And there's no harm in it being written by a man. You Don't Own Me, the Leslie Gore song, was written by a man. The lyrics to Will You Love Me Tomorrow by Goffin and King were written by a man. The problem with the author of these lyrics was not his gender, but his brain. J.D. Miller was an avowed segregationist. And during this civil rights era, in the 1950s and 1960s, he founded a record company called Red Rebel Records out of Crowley, Louisiana. At Red Rebel, Miller took under his wing a Cajun singer that he groomed named D.J. Trahan, renamed him Johnny Rebel, and produced a series of records that stand among the most vile expressions of hate that I've ever been exposed to. Now, these songs I thought were dead and gone, and they've come back over the past year through websites for neo-Nazi groups and hate groups in a new category that's now called hatecore. And you could find all these Johnny Rebel songs, which I thought were a footnote to history, obscure music arcana, are back. I will not repeat the titles of these songs or discuss them any further. And I don't encourage you to look them up unless you are bulimic and and feel the urge to adjust. But it's just a reminder that protest takes many forms. People can protest wrongs, and people protest rights, and employ music for that purpose. They protest injustice and protest justice. For right or wrong, music can serve those multiple purposes. At this point, I think it might be nice to lighten our spirits, and a good time for Jill to sing a more enlightened piece of work. This is a Loretta Lynn song from 1975 that followed her song One's on the Way, which was 1971. This was banned from radio stations when it was released in 75. Fortunately, the ban only had the effect of enhancing its appeal, and it became one of Lynn's best-known songs.
You wined me and dined me when I was your girl. Promised that I'd be your wife, you'd show the world. But all seen of this old world is a bed and a doctor bill. I'm tearing down your broader house, cause I've got the pill. All these years I've stayed at home, you've had all your fun. And every year that's gone by, another baby has come. There's gonna be some changes right here on Nursery Hill. You set this chicken your last time, now I've got the pill. This old maternity dress I got is going in the garbage. The clothes I'm wearing from now on won't take up so much yardage. Mini skirts and hot pants and a few little fancy trills. Yeah, I'm making up for all those years since I've got the pill. I'm tired of your crowing, how your hands play. While holding a couple in my arms, another's on my way. This chicken's done and tore a nest, ready to make a deal. Can't afford to turn it down, cause I got the pill. This incubator's overused because I kept it filled. The feeling comes easy now since I got the pill. It's getting dark, it's roasting time. Tonight's good to be real. But daddy, don't you worry none, cause mama's got the pill. Daddy, don't you worry now, cause mama's got the pill.
Yeah. Yeah. Another very potent song of feminism or proto-feminism in popular music, it's worth us considering for a minute, is You Don't Own Me, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, sung by Leslie Gore. That's a particularly significant case because it demonstrates how popular music functions on the generational divide. You Don't Own Me was released in 1963. And that's the same year that another song was in the top 40 with it, a song by Hal David and Burt Bacharach called Wives and Lovers. Wives and Lovers was a hit song by Jack Jones, and the lyrics went, "Hey, hey, little girl. Little girl," so it refers to the woman in the song, even though she's married, as little girl. "Hey, little girl, comb your hair, fix your makeup. Soon he will walk through that door. Don't think because there's a ring on your finger, you needn't try anymore, for wives must always be lovers too. Run to his arms whenever he comes to you. I'm warning you. Day after day, there are girls at the office, and men will always be men." women must always be lovers too. So that was Jack Jones singing to adults of the jet set while teenagers are listening to You Don't Own Me. And I still remember being a kid and having my big sister, who is 6 years older than me, listening to You Don't Own Me and like sitting me down and saying, listen to this. She wanted to make sure I got this message when I was impressionable. Gloria Steinem once said, Leslie Gore was there before me. She primed a whole generation of teenage girls to become feminist women. Now, we all, I think, know how the music functioned to integrate America. American music is essentially African. The essence of American music is African-American music. And American music was integrated before the schools were integrated in this country. Then rock and roll emerged during the same time as Brown versus Education in the 1950s. I want, during the last 5 minutes I have, before I ask Jill to sing one more song, to talk about another way in which popular music expressed dissent in ways that we might not think of as an expression of dissent, and that is disco. Now, when you came today, you might not have thought you were going to hear a lecture about disco, but I want to use my last 4 minutes and 45 seconds to talk about disco. Now, pop fads can have underlying substance. The disco craze played a critical role in the rise of gay consciousness in America during the 1970s. There was a form of protest, an expression of dissent, and a call for unity in disco, on the dance floors of the dance clubs, the gay dance clubs, as both male and female. As the novelist and memoirist Edmund White said, he said, quote, disco was the soundtrack of the great gay coming out party after Stonewall. No more hiding like frightened squirrels in sleazy little bars. Disco came into prominence at the same time as the gay renaissance, and there's no question that disco helped make it possible. Hundreds of men dancing together in those vast and lavish spaces. It was thrilling. The president of Fantasy Records told Newsweek at the time, quote, disco was a symbolic call for gays to come out of the closet and dance with each other. So what's he talking about? Imagine moving to songs with words interpretable as messages of unity and celebration. I will survive. I Am What I Am by Gloria Gaynor, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real by Sylvester, and even all the campy gay anthems by the Village People like Macho Man, YMCA, and In the Navy. In all that material, gay men and women found themselves grouped by the hundreds in a space, both physical and emotional, in which they were part of a community, a collective body with the ability to work in synchronization. I think we'll go from there into one more song by Jill, and this will close out the formal part of this presentation with this, and then we'll take some questions. This is one of Jill's hits. Should I say anything about it? You're just going to do it?
Sure.
Okay. This is one of the seminal songs of the 1990s and a first big hit for Jill called I Kissed a Girl. Not the one by Katy Perry. This is the original. Jill will now play Kissed a Girl.
And this was also banned on some stations, which made me feel so cool. Jenny came over and told me about Fred. He's such a hairy behemoth, she said. Dumb as a box of hammers, but he's such a handsome guy. And I opened up and I told about Larry, and yesterday how he asked me to marry, not giving him an answer yet. I think I can do better. And we laughed, compared notes. We had a drink, we had a smoke. She took off her overcoat. I kissed a girl. She called home to say she'd be late. He said he worried, but now he feels safe. I'm glad you're with your girlfriend. Tell her hi for me. Then I looked at you, yeah, guilt in your eyes, but it only lasted a little while. Then I felt your hand above my knees. And we laughed at the world. They can have that dime. diamonds and we'll have our pearls. I kissed a girl. Well, I kissed a girl, her lips were sweet. She was just like kissing me. Kissed a girl, changed the world, and I'm so glad I kissed a girl. Well, I kissed a girl, her lips were sweet. She was just like kissing me, but better. Kissed a girl. Well, I kissed a girl, won't change the world, but I'm so glad I